Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, it's episode 459. I'm happy to bring you a preview of the March 2025 edition of Retinal Physician. Retinal Physician is found online at retinalphysician.com and in print. This issue focuses on geographic atrophy and intermediate AMD. So we spend some time talking about photobiomodulation for AMD, complement inhibition for geographic atrophy, and also a deep learning algorithm for assessing GA. Happy to be joined by Drs. Kat Talcott and Akshay Thomas for this one, and I hope you enjoy. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with the preview of the March 2025 edition of Retinal Physician. Retinal Physician is found online and in print. You can find it online at retinalphysician.com. This month's issue focuses on dry age-related macular degeneration and geographic atrophy. And I can't think of two better people to talk about this than these colleagues from around the country. First, Dr. Kat Talcott in Cleveland, Ohio. Kat, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
And Dr. Akshay Thomas in Nashville, Tennessee.
How's it going, Jay? Thanks for having me back.
Awesome. We've covered our geography. Now let's cover our atrophy. We've got two articles on GA and one article about PVM, which is obviously a hot topic, which we've talked about a couple times now on the podcast. So again, I'm going to summarize these articles. If you want to read them, you can go ahead and read them yourself. This is not designed for the listener to be an exhaustive review, but rather jumping off points for our discussion. So the first article, let's start with PVM. So David Boyer, who's been on the podcast talking about PVM, he was the senior author, along with Samuel Asenad, in an article titled Photobiomodulation Therapy Delays Dry AMD Progression, subtitle Multi-Wavelength PVM Approach Shows Visual Acuity and Disease Morphology Benefits. And just to quickly summarize the article, they start with the intro that, look, there's no available treatment for early to intermediate dry AMD besides antioxidant supplementation, aka AREDS vitamins. They then go into PVM and discussing what PVM is, which is using light in the visible to near infrared spectrum, ideally to give you cellular response in targeted tissues. And they talk about the Valita light system, which is the Lumithera photobiomodulation system approved in November 2024 by the FDA. It's the first approved treatment for vision loss in dry AMD patients. And there's three wavelengths, yellow, red, and near infrared. And then essentially, they want to go through the mechanism of action. PVM has been talked about for many, many years. It may do something involving cytochrome C oxidase, which is important as a photoreceptor for light and may allow cells to be healthier and boost electron transport pathway, boost ATP production. Sounds, not to go flip it, it sounds a little bit like some of the supplements I see on TikTok and Instagram that tell me that my ATP is going to be higher. But there is science behind this and that it may reduce cellular stress. So they then go to the background. Previous studies had talked about maybe PVM was potentially helpful and go into an exhaustive detail of the light site. So light site trials were 1 and 2 and 3, essentially going to PVM in larger numbers of patients. We've talked about the trial results a little bit. If you just go to LightSight 3, I think we can skip past the first two. If you want to read those, you can go ahead and read them if you're listening. But LightSight 3, sham treatment, 54 eyes, multi-wavelength PVM in 91 eyes, treatment cycles, 9 sessions conducted over 3 to 5 weeks. You get cycles repeated at 4-month intervals for up to 24 months, and you can get multiple treatment cycles. So you can see short-term and long-term, does PVM have improvements over sham? Sham group did get some light, but not at the dose that would be necessary for cellular activation. So patients were masked that way. And so the take-home point that you had statistically significant improvements in vision based on 100 treated eyes, 100 patients, 148 eyes with intermediate AMD greater than 50, and 55% demonstrated an increase of nearly 2 lines in best-corrected visual acuity. Moreover, there was a significant decrease in new onset GA, 6.8% in the treated group versus 24% in the sham group. And then macular drusen volume tended to be stable in the PVM group versus sham eye drusen volume tended to increase over the study period. This feeds into the conclusions from the study that PVM is doing something to slow down or halt pathologic processes in AMD. And vision loss was reduced by 53%, GA onset by 73% at month 24. And they end by saying there was no safety signals, most common adverse events, foreign body sensation, tearing, discomfort, PVD, blepharitis, conge, hemorrhage. And so the conclusion was they say it offers safe treatment. There's potential anatomic improvements, decreased vision loss, and maybe even increase in visual acuity. There is a registry study called Urolite that's ongoing. And I'm sure we'll start to see some post-market trials now that the drug is available, excuse me, the treatment is available. So Kat, PBM, are you a believer? Are you a skeptic? Are you somewhere in between? Did they convince you when you read this paper?
It's a really well-written article. And I so want for, you know, the field of GA for there to be better treatments.
That's like the equivalent of saying someone has a nice personality when I ask, is this person a good colleague? And you're like, well, they have a really nice personality. Go ahead. I know where you're going with this.
I was just thinking if you were going to go to me first, and I was like, I should try and do like the feedback sandwich of like something nice. And then, you know, they call me a skeptic, but like, this study is like not very large, and I just like don't have a lot of trust in the studies. You know, in some ways, similarly, like when I think of like biosimilar studies and like what the clinical trial design looks like, it's just so different than the rest of our therapies that are approved that are held to like a pretty high standard. It's just, it's hard for me to believe that like a treatment can improve vision that is just light treatment. And I just worry because this is like a really susceptible population that wants so much to have options for improving. Like I see my patients who are willing to pay whatever for whatever supplement they saw online to be able to help their vision. That, you know, light treatment in some ways offers an opportunity for patients to get a treatment that improves their like vision, but also for like other people in the healthcare space to be able to take advantage of those patients. Like for instance, one of my colleagues who's like a comprehensive person said that someone else reached out to her to ask if this treatment was approved because they were thinking about getting it. And that person is like a refractive person. And so I'm like, are you going to get this machine and like start charging people? And, you know, I hope that this works. Like it'd be great for patients if this treatment works. I just feel like the data that we have, it's like essentially like 150 patients is like not enough for me to feel convinced that this is a treatment that's worthwhile for patients, especially, I mean, I doubt people's insurances are going to be covering it. That might be like, you know, $2,000 out of pocket for like a series of treatments. So that's me. Call me a skeptic. But again, well-written article, ending the feedback sandwich. Like nice communication of the data, but I'm skeptical.
Is your division purchasing machine?
No.
Not yet. Okay. Akshay, what about you guys? What are your thoughts? And is your practice purchasing the machine at this point?
We're not. And I mean, I think Kat echoed a lot of my thoughts and also the excellent opinion piece that we discussed from Vasada, which is, yeah, we don't have a ton of data. We all really hope it works. But I think in addition to whether it works or not, we really don't know if there's any negative side effects, right? I think there have been reports of this being used in China, you know, to slow myopia, and like a 12-year-old getting some type of maculopathy with it. So if we're really going to, you know, depend on 150 eyes, a year's worth of data to tell us about the good, bad, and the ugly with this, I don't think we've really gotten that at all, right? So I do worry exactly what Kat worried about is that even hypothetically if it did work, we talked about this, you know, where are we going to find space, you know, for 27 office visits over a year, you know, for these patients? I highly doubt this is something that's going to be marketed to most retina doctors, at least now. I think marketing may be, you know, like Kat said, to some of our referring doctors who may be, you know, doing this with good intentions, but, you know, are they truly going to follow them as well as one of us does? I don't know. So I'm also a little skeptic, and I think we have to, if we're gonna, you know, look at the small amount of good data, we have to look at the small amount of bad data. There is a higher rate of neovascularization, right, in LightSide 3 and eyes getting PVM than those not. So, you know, we can't sweep that under the rug and say, oh, you know, the 1.5 or 2 letters of, you know, better vision is enough to justify that, right? So, have to wait and see.
Yeah, I mean, I've made my thoughts on this. I think I don't necessarily, like you said, we don't know enough. I think we know that there may be promise here. It probably is worthy of very motivated patients, kind of similar to when complement therapy came out, which we'll talk about later in this podcast. I think that the numbers are small. Some statisticians would argue this: if you have small numbers, which is a significant difference, then that may be even more significant. I think the safety issue is interesting, right? Because what would be the number of patients to have a problem where you'd start to get worried, right? With intravitreal injections, 1 in 400 with brolucizumab was sort of unacceptable, but we had alternatives that worked. if you have a slowly progressive condition that's not always progressive, but sometimes is, what's the acceptable rate of a safety event? For example, it could be a safety event as simple as choroidal neovascularization, which is interesting, right? Because Prégier, you're going from, well, this is a we know that this is a condition that tends to progress over a slow amount of time. What's the chance I'll take a risk for CNVM that may require, the burden of therapy, risk of hemorrhage, risk of vision loss? But this is even taking a step backwards, right? Which is like, well, you have a condition where these patients could be stable. Yes, drusen volume may increase over time. We know it's a degenerative disease over time, but there's a lot of variability between patients. Which patients are the ones who should be the most, in which patients is the risk worth it if there is a risk, right? And so these are the questions that we don't really know because, again, the numbers are small. And unless you guys have other thoughts about complement therapy, and we can tie into this. I want to tie this into complement inhibition because Thomas Ciulla was senior author in another article from this issue with Amer Suguri that was complement inhibition for GA. And again, inhibition of complement system offers a promising approach to slow GA progression, but challenges remain was the subtitle. Not to get too exhausted, we've talked about complement quite a bit, but again, they summarize there's two complement inhibitors for GA available on the market. We have now Syfovre and Izervay, C3 inhibitor, C5 inhibitor. They review the complement system. For those of you who don't remember your complement system from medical school, I'm sure you've seen these diagrams more than you thought you ever would since these drugs came on the market. But essentially, the complement system is important in AMD, right? There is an inflammation that causes the apoptosis and the loss of cell function as well as cell volume. And so they talk about the reasons that the complement system was targeted. And there's the common pathway in the terminal pathway, C3 in the common pathway, C5 in the terminal pathway. And then finally, there's the alternative pathway, which is the alternative pathway could be a target as well. And there is Abbisita, Regata, Gyroscope, and several other companies that are looking at the alternative pathway. And they have a nice summary slide looking at things under investigation. So we know about the things that are on the market, but you have Janssen, you have Abbisita, you have Alexion, you have Annexon, all with different complement inhibitors targeting CD59, CFH, CFD inhibitor, and C1q inhibitor, respectively. All dosed intravitreal, except for the denicumab from Alexion's orally given, which is kind of interesting, and all in different phases, most of them right now in phase two, except for Annexon, which is in phase three, which is recruiting right now. So I thought this was a really good review of, and just to be complete, the classical pathway would be C1q, which is Annexon. So I thought this was a really good review of kind of like where we are right now, what's down the line. We have proof of concept, Kat, that the complement system is potentially helpful. It's just interesting again to think about dosing and think about relative efficacy, and these are questions that the companies don't have to answer immediately, but now that there are drugs in the market, they can see how the adoption is taking place, and they can see the barriers to adoption that are there. You start thinking about ideal delivery method, and I think the big things are, if you're going to go intravitreal injection, what's the least frequent dosing that you can do? What's the timeline for dosing? Which again, no trial is going to answer. It sounds like indefinite for any one of these therapies. And then if you're going to go orally, that maybe the most convenient because the patient doesn't have to come in for the visits, but then you'll just get to handle systemic side effects, things like that. Any thoughts? Because to me, just reading that table without any financial stake in any of them, my first thing was like, if the oral one works, that's the one that I'd probably go to because that's the easiest from treatment burden for the patient, treatment burden from the practice, and sustainability over time. But I'm curious if you had similar reactions or anything stood out to you from this paper.
Yeah, I thought it was a really nice summary of everything in the space. And there is like so much in the space that's it's interesting because as someone who, I never thought we would talk, I agree with you, never thought we were talking about a complement system as much as we are in sort of ophthalmology. But there's so much crowding in the space and you kind of it makes you wonder, like, are these other agents that are still just affecting the same pathway going to be that more efficacious than what's already on the market? And like for me, as as I utilize complement inhibitors in like my practice, like it's a lot to ask these patients to come in every month or two for the rest of their life. So if we can find some way to sort of avoid that, that would be fantastic. So I think avoiding intravitreal injections as like the treatment, I agree, is like most attractive. And there's some intravitreal injections, that, might be efficacious that might just be like one-time treatments, such as like Janssen's product. But you do run the risk of like potential like inflammation in those cases. I just wonder, and it'll be interesting to see because all these things are in phase two, are the agents that are in development in development going to be that much more efficacious than what's already on the market if they're targeting the complement system as a whole? Or do we need to look as a field sort of outside of this pathway to be able to get something that's more efficacious? So I'm curious to get your guys' thoughts, but I think one of my concerns with the approved treatments is, it's great to be able to tell patients that we're sort of slowing their geographic atrophy. But I mean, patients don't get super excited about that when you kind of go over realistically what sort of the goals of treatment are. So I think it's great to have a lot of stuff in the space. I hope we have more options for patients, but I hope the results for these trials, can show some functional difference at the end of at the end of the 2 year period.
What do you think, Akshay?
I think the last point that Ked mentioned is what I harp on the most, which is, people a lot smarter than I will say that, well, yeah, maybe those GA lesions are not growing as much, but those are just sick RPE cells that are not being cleared and they're just not functional. So, like, how much of a functional benefit are we really having? And I have zero answers for that. I think when you're designing the trials for someone as a consumer, what I find very hard to understand is how to actually interpret that results where I feel confident using them, even if you have a head-to-head, right? I mean, like, what measures and what metrics are you using to show me there's truly a functional superiority over two patients that may have baseline different rates of GA growth that you just cannot control for, other than lesion maybe size and location, and using historical data for how these thing and modeling for how these lesions would typically tend to grow. So that all that being said, I think it would be most palatable to have a systemic option, both from a patient's perspective and from my perspective. I'm assuming that we, as a community, have a good understanding of what the side effects systemically of those medications are as well.
Yeah, it's early, right? And I think you both bring up good points. Kat, your point about what is a good, like, let's say they're equal. I mean, then there will be arguments between the companies, like, which mine's better because it targets this, or mine's better because you're, and then you're comparing trials that were done in different populations with different inclusion criteria, the same stuff that we talk about at meetings over and over again. It's like, okay, it just gets more messy. And I don't know how people would pick which one to use, right? It would sort of become, because it's, again, it's just, there's nothing, no sort of short-term marker that we have yet that tells you whether the treatment is efficacious or more efficacious than another treatment. So it's not even like you can do an easy post-market study, right? A lot of the anti-VEGF drugs, when they come out, there's real-world studies that hit the pages 6 or 12 months after. People presenting at Retina Society, ASRS, Academy, VBS, they're going to Macula Society. They're showing their short-term real-world data. And that, again, those are retrospective, biased maybe by small groups, but it's useful to start looking at real world data and getting a sense, like, okay, like, if you're switching to faricimab or you're switching to high dose of aflibercept, what sort of impact is that having? You can't really do that easily. Like, I don't see a way you would do that because you don't have easy, clean markers in a very short amount of time. You'd have to do some sort of long term retrospective look back, and you're not going to have switch studies, right? You're not going to have. How do you compare patients then? They're not going to be equal patients. They couldn't make the patients equal in two different trials. It's going to be pretty difficult to find real world patients and match them up to be exactly the same in terms of the GA. I mean, it's a little tied into this last article, which is different. It's about imaging in GA, which is by Simrat Sodhi with Nitin Choudhury as a senior author, Dave Boyer, Charlie Wyckoff, and Hasse Alkerson on this one as well, which is using deep learning modules to identify GA area. And they talk about the GEODe study. The GEODe study essentially is taking real world data from clinical practice and then is using the clinical data to develop automated GA algorithms, right? And so one of the things about the GEODe study, it's Retina Consultants of Texas, Retina Vitreous Associates, and VRMTO up in Toronto, is they take patients with GA or GA other pathologies, and they're using the neural net to try to find ways to use deep learning to help us better understand which patients, first of all, first you have to image the GA, right? And get a good sense of what the actual area of GA is in an easy, reproducible, and accurate manner rather than manually measuring it. But then the real question will be is, can you use this to ultimately know, track GA over time and know what's happening? And then that would be a marker that you could show if it could be an easy algorithm. We've said this many times on this podcast. If you could show hey, this is what your GA is doing. Hey, this is what the model predicts your GA would do if you didn't have treatment. Then maybe you could start to do some of the useful tests that would make newer drugs on the market more palatable for retina specialists rather than more confusing. And you'd be able to motivate these patients to continue treatment. But Kat, I'm curious, did you think of anything else when you were reading this paper?
Jay, you're going to be first about every article. I think
I'm just trying to go back and forth. Akshay, you want to go first?
Akshay
You go first.
should
So I think Kat is really wants to talk about this article, and it would be a shame for me to prohibit her from doing that. So
Well,
Kat,
Akshay,
please
do you
go
want to
ahead.
talk about why they should
No,
have removed
I'm happy.
Glofitamab?
I'm happy to do it. I'm just giving you a hard time. I think the thing in this space is it's really hard to be able to sort of know because we're so used to the anti-VEGF space where there's fluid and we treat fluid and then the fluid gets better and we're like very adept at sort of being able to monitor that. But like to be honest, in the GA space, it's hard to be able to do that. Like you can get FAF on people, and for sure I do. And when I see patients in trials, of course they're getting all the imaging. But to be honest, like and just in like my regular practice, like I'll see a lot of patients who are sent to me for potential GA treatment, or I'm following them for like AMD, and I have to talk to, I have to present options to patients. And to be honest, I'm using mostly like OCT to be able to see if there's a problem. So I think there's 100% a need for better programs to be able to sort of identify GA that's present and to be able to track. As I have patients, I have some patients who are on like GA treatment with complement inhibitors. It's hard to sort of know exactly like what metrics to follow because like some of these patients are going to get worse even if they're on treatment, and you have to consider whether or not to continue. So I'm all for more information in the space for being able to sort of track what GA looks like and how that changes over time. It's just it, because if you try and do it in real time in clinic, it's hard to do that in like a quick manner. Like if I'm looking at someone's like fundus autofluorescence or like their infrared imaging, I'm only pulling up like sort of one time frame for those patients. It's harder to get sort of a longitudinal view. So I'm all for in this space, and I appreciate the authors doing more work in this area to come up with models that don't require as much time on our part and can give us information about the rate of change for who's good candidates and potentially if they're changing in response to treatment.
Akshay, you get to go second again.
All right. So, what I was going to say is that I really enjoy all these articles that people put out, which, have sophisticated algorithms from people that are way smarter than myself to measure volume of subretinal fluid and GA. And I'm like, great, when can I get that in my in on all my
You
OCT machines
also
too?
did a sandwich compliment. That was really good. I felt it coming. You're like, I was like, he's being really gracious right now. What is he about to say?
No, it's no, I mean, I think it's about, like how do we get our OCT manufacturers to have some uniformity across platforms for something that we can use to actually measure, incorporate this into our practice outside of, begging someone for their algorithm, right? But I do think if we had a way of measuring like some, GA change velocity, right? We have lots of historical data on our OCT machines. And if you're using OCT, you're like, okay, this is what my patient's GA velocity was prior, and then I'm injecting them, and now their velocity seems to have taken a change. I might actually have more buy-in for using some of these agents, right? So if there's a way to simplify and actually give me legit numbers, whether it's for GA or IRORA or whatever you want to measure, it's only value added. I feel like we've just always struggled to get all these amazing tools into clinics, right? And that's the biggest challenge I have.
Yes, I would agree. I think it's cool to talk about very few algorithms have hit the clinic. I feel like most of us, you could say the only quote unquote easy imaging algorithm most of us use routinely is like your central macular thickness comparison or your Heidelberg, for example, or any of these companies where they match the OCTs. You can scroll through both. Besides that, I can't think of something that people are using routinely from an imaging perspective, right? We don't even have great mapping for optos, right? I'm sure actually you would love that for optos wide field FAs. You're kind of having to pull up the old one, pull up the new one, scroll through each one independently. Unless there's a way I know to match it, it's not like you can just scroll through it and just like see the comparison. Even better would be if you overlay the images and then you can see the relative decrease in leakage, non-perfusion, things like that. Just highlight the areas that have changed versus relying on your memory to do it. But I guess that's why they pay us the big bucks and why we're not replaced by the AI yet.
Enjoy while lasts.
Enjoy the last. I mean, not to, and we can end with this, like, I think that I have felt, not to be a pun, no pun intended, I felt like DryMD and GA, I remember being a resident or fellow, was always kind of my least favorite section of any meeting I would go to, because it was very not, and just as, again, I'm not smart enough to maybe understand all that. It was very data heavy. It was very imaging biomarker heavy. It was very heavy on therapeutics that weren't available yet. And I feel differently about it. I think we're talking about, it's more interesting to talk about than it used to be because now we do have options. I think we've all kind of hinted there's still a tremendous unmet need, both in imaging that is useful in day-to-day practice and in treatment. And that's why, like, as good as PBM may look, maybe it will be awesome. As good as complement inhibitors have been relative to nothing, maybe over time they'll be awesome. It's just we're so spoiled by anti-VEGF and even our surgeries that can be really dramatic. We take a retina, detach, reattach it. You take a macular hole, you close it. Obviously, the vision is not always as satisfying from a surgical perspective, but you still hit those home runs. You don't, and none of these offer that home runs, which is, I think, why we're all sort of, I'm not trying to be negative about it, but why, like, these issues are important to keep track of what's going on, but it's still like a once a year check-in to be like, okay, like what's new in GA dry AMD? Okay, this is new. I'm going to come back in a year. And if I come back in a year, I'm not really going to miss something that is groundbreaking, right? I'm not going to miss something that totally changes my practice. Oh my God, I'm so behind. And that's what, I mean, maybe it's part of the patience of dealing with the slow disease process. I guess that's Kat, maybe while we're all sort of just like really nice personality. But, and then we're kind of giving the buds after that.
There's just so much room in this space for sort of for new treatment. If there was a treatment that would like come and improve vision reliably in a way that we all felt comfortable with, and then maybe just even completely stop or improve visual function, I think we would all be excited. And it is exciting to have so much industry partners in this space, because it feels like every week there's an update of like who's advancing whatever trial or but it just I hope that the results of this next phase of like phase two, phase three studies is good for the field and good for our patients. And I just hope in the meantime, like our patients don't get taken advantage of.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. We have to talk about it. I mean, like most places, I feel like won't talk about that because it's not a scientific discussion, because there's no data. It's just sort of an anecdotal thing. But I think it's important to have the ethical discussion. Like, obviously, that's not the responsibility of Lumathera. It's not the responsibility of Dr. Boyer or PIs for the study. You can't control every lowest common denominator. We've talked about that with other things, whether it's port delivery system, whether it's when do you put a certain IOL in. Like, but this is part of the educational piece and sort of the, what do they call that? The steward, like being a steward of the field and protective of patients. Like, you just, it's sad that that's the first place that all of us go is like, well, someone's going to just like take these and crank them out in patients with like tiny, the single Druze who's not really an ideal candidate. And, it's not necessarily the best thing economically for some of these patients, not economically best for the system. And it's maybe there's a side effect profile, actually. It's maybe not best for the patient themselves. And I think that's just, we've got to guard against that. It's hard. It's hard. Like, I was having a conversation today with a colleague who's an anterior segment surgeon, and anterior segment surgeries conversations are very different than posterior segment surgeons when it comes to the economics of what they do. It's much more front and center for what they do because there's so much more cash pay and there's so much more advertising, that sort of thing. Like, obviously, you have to balance sort of the profit making, the capitalism with the idealism, but I just wonder if. I don't know where that line has to be drawn, but it'd be more interesting if we like that became more part of the conversation at congresses or in viewpoints like last night. Like, it's not a scientific discussion, but it's sort of the caution is like, hey, like don't sell snake oil, basically. Like, make sure that you actually believe in it and make sure it's the right patient. Don't just do it because it's easy, it's profitable, and it adds to the bottom line of your practice. Because obviously you can rationalize in many ways. There's Medicare cuts, there's things you want to do to remain solvent, but like there's making money doing something that works, and there's making money just doing stuff. And I think that you have to differentiate that it's not all the same.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think one thing definitely from with this FDA approval pulling light side is now I have my PBM talk ready and available for patients because, even with complement, whether I choose to use it or not, I feel like they need to hear about it from me. Others are going to hear about it from someone else and wonder like, oh, wonder why Dr. Thomas didn't tell me he could have been treating my GA all this time, or wonder why Dr. Thomas didn't tell me he could have been treating my intermediate AMD. Or they might get, maybe not, perhaps not as good information from someone else. So whether we choose to use it or not, regardless, I think we need to have it needs to be added to the talks we have with our AMD patients now, since it's now FDA authorized for them to market it.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. And I wonder if it's like the chair time, right? People complained a lot about chair time with GA because your relative chair time to output, and even if you're not working economics, the actual benefit to the patient is not as much, but it's the educational piece. There's chair time involved here. And it doesn't have to be a long amount of chair time. You could probably come with a 30-second sort of quick summary of, hey, this thing's available, this is why I don't do it. If you hear about it, I'm happy to chat about it in the future. Or vice versa. It's probably hopefully longer chair time if you're trying to convince someone to do it. But anyway, any final thoughts, Kat or Akshay, before we break?
No, I really appreciated this like discussion, and it made me appreciate that the feedback sandwich is still alive and well.
Feedback
So
sandwich.
thanks
But
for
the
calling me
problem is,
out on
if you've
that.
heard the feedback sandwich enough, or you've given it enough, you get the. I was instantly both times you got started. I'm like, there's something coming. It wasn't. You guys are very nice people. It was a little too nice to start the compliment right off. No pun intended, the compliment right off the bat. I don't know. Some people say you need a 7-layer burrito now. You need three compliments for every criticism and then another three on the other side. That is a dated reference because I don't think Taco Bell has that anymore. But okay.
All the first
Kat.
authors on the article did a great job. Great
They did.
job
Oh, you know,
generating these
look, they're all
sentences.
really well written. And if you were listening, you should read it. I mean, I think it's worth reading it just to educate yourself. I don't think anyone here is writing anything untrue, dishonest, or biased. I just think that this is just sort of the analysis of the situation is like, okay, like, well, what's the take home? And I think the take home is TBD, I think is what we're saying. So, Kat, Akshay, thank you so much for your time. And hopefully, see you guys at the meeting at BBS in a few weeks.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Jay.
See you there, Jay.
Take care. Many thanks to Drs. Talcott and Thomas for joining me for this episode. Listeners, remember there are 459 episodes, including this one, on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINA podcast.com. They're all there and archived for your listening pleasure. You can also reach out with episode ideas. You can email me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com or click on the contact us link on our website. Thanks to our whole production team, especially Dr. Justin Ma, who put together this episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here each week, and the papers that you publish, just like the articles written today, that give us something to talk about and listen to when we are commuting. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.